On today's exciting episode of Higher Learning, we are joined by Tim Todorai. Tim is a longtime HR executive in the life sciences space that most recently opened up his own consulting business by the name of Plotline. Tim has so much to share, from his love of boxing and how it applies to interviewing, to what it's like to work in the life sciences industry, to what he would tell his younger self as advice. Tim has so much to share and a lot of great insights when it comes to HR and HR in your organization. I can't wait for you to listen to this episode and let us know what you think. Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid, and today we have a very special guest. Today we are joined by Tim Todorai. Tim is the founder and CHRO of Plotline Leadership. How are you doing today, Tim?
Doing great. How about you?
I'm doing great, man. So you're out in Raleigh, you said, right?
Oh, yeah.
All right, I'll give you a minute here. You're the Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. Tell us why we should move to Raleigh.
Beautiful weather, reasonable taxes. Delightful people. You can't go wrong.
Wow. I am sold. What about the food situation? I'm big on good food.
Oh, man. I moved down from New York 20 years ago, and it was a little tough back then, but now it is fantastic. It's like you can get whatever you want. Maybe a little bit on the pizza situation. Still got to go back home, but otherwise you're in good shape.
Okay. So if I heard you right, pizza, bagels, New York, everything else you can get in Raleigh.
Indeed.
I love it. So I want to ask you, bud, I appreciate you coming on. You spent your career as an HR leader, particularly in the life sciences industry, before opening up Plotline. How is people and talent, how is that different in life sciences compared to other industries?
Well, you know, it's funny, when you first join life science, you can easily get overwhelmed by just the sheer brain power of people. I mean, these are just brilliant individuals, and they think in metrics and ROI and all of that, and they really push you on ideas because a lot of them are academically oriented, so they're going to challenge you in every way. But it's funny, you know, when you go outside of that industry, you discover pretty quickly that that's not so unique. Like, every, you know, industry demands excellence, and every organization has rock stars. So, you know, actually, you look at more of the similarities. And one of them is I discovered that it's like usually a balance of art and science, and getting people to think about both, especially in the HR space, is one of the things that if you can make that connection, you're doing pretty good.
I love that. So you are with multiple companies in the life sciences space. And I just wonder, was that an intentional thought process going into your career? Or was it, this was kind of where you first kind of started, and then it just naturally, those became the companies that were attracted to your experience? Was it kind of a chicken or the egg thing?
No, it's a little bit of both. I mean, it's a great story to tell backwards, and I think most career stories are, because you can fill in the plot lines as you go. But, you know, going forward, it's you're opportunistic. You think about what's missing from your resume, what's missing from, you know, the things that you need to build your career, and you chase those. So I, at one point, sold nuclear fuel. I mean, that was in college. That's where I started. But then I was able to leverage that sales technique to sell training product. And that's what launched me into HR. So I taught karate at one point. I leveraged that teaching skill to teach training, right? So you think about these parallels in your career, and you go chase one after the other. And before you know it, you look back and go, oh, that was a long road, but it got me to a pretty cool place. So, you know, part of it is just doing that.
Yeah, I love that. You know, story time here. I was talking with my daughter yesterday. We were just sitting and eating, and she was talking about how she wants to be an astronomer, right? And this is something she's wanted for a couple of years, but she's worried that if she focuses too much on being an astronomer, then she's going to miss out on a bunch of other great opportunities, because there are lots of things she likes. By the way, she's 12 years old. So I said to her, I go, listen, let me give you a little bit about my career path, right? I went to law school thinking that I was going to take that and leverage that. Then I ended up taking a job at a corporate organization in technology, because they would pay for my law school. But guess what? I never actually went to law school. So then I started working in that space, and I got promoted 3 times in 4 years, and I grew up in that company. And then I started doing hiring for my own job. And then I realized that the hiring industry was woefully lacking, which then led me to go into a career of executive search eventually before opening up my own company. Now, very happy and fulfilled with what I'm doing, but no one would have written that story from A to B. And that's what you really have to be in your career. You have to be opportunistic. You have to have an idea. So I told her, I go, hey, listen, focus on astronomy for right now. You might find things that you, later on down the road, that you don't want to actually get into that. But you know what you're going to do a lot of right now to get to astronomy? Math and science. And you're going to get really good grades. And you know what those do? Those help give you a lot of options and opportunities. So have a goal, but be smart enough to know when do you want to commit and when do you want to pivot, but focus on getting like the skills that you need. So anyway, that's a long story for me to tell you that. Totally agree with that. And that's how life usually turns out. Very few careers are linear from A to B or A to Z.
I hear you, man. But it's important because that's the X factor that you bring to the table. That if, you know, if I'm hiring a project manager and they all have the same background, they all have the same skill sets, and then you go to say, well, hey, what's the thing that you bring to the table that's different? What's your X factor? And somebody tells you, well, I have this unique background, unique skill set that everybody else doesn't. Well, you might just pop right to the top of the list. So, don't lose sight of the things that you've learned in your life because they can come in handy, right?
I love that. I love that. And listen, you've taken an entrepreneurial journey of your own over the last so many, say, years. You opened up your own consultancy, I guess, about a decade ago, where you do a lot of HR and executive coaching. What led to this decision? What areas do you specialize in? And what was like the moment that got you to take the jump?
You know, it actually started as a side hustle, and I'm just a big fan of people having that diversification. And frankly, I started it for income diversification and to guard against the ever-changing corporate pronouns. You know what I mean? We did this, we did that, they fired me. That can happen to anybody at any time, and it can be really terrible. But if you're prepared for it and you have a little bit of something extra, some other things on the side, then it's less painful. So you can navigate that. Everybody has that experience in life. So that's number one. The other thing is when you have a side hustle or something you're doing differently, you actually are learning constantly and you're benefiting yourself by bringing that knowledge, but you're also benefiting your company because you're bringing different perspectives and unique things to that. And again, creating that X factor that other people don't have. So that's really what I did. And then I just was doing the same thing, learning the lessons over and over again. And I said, I want to specialize. I started specialization in OD and talent management, went into the general world of M&A and doing then HCRO stuff. And finally, I said, you know what? I want to go do what you love. And what I love is helping companies change their culture, enhance performance, and drive their talent. That's what I like. So that's what I ended up doing.
Now, how long in the journey, like, did you have immediate success? Did it take a little bit of time? Obviously, there's ups and downs, but I'm just interested to kind of know what the first years of the journey were like.
Yeah, so it's interesting when you start. It's definitely a shock because you have to go back into entrepreneurial mode. But if you plan it and you've had your side hustle going for a while, you can leverage some of those contacts to drive the business that you want. You're also in different stages of your life too. I mean, you start this in your 20s, different time, different financial goals, different things. You get a little bit older, your priorities change, what you're trying to focus on. And I think ultimately we all come to the place where time is the most valuable resource and the biggest status symbol you could ever have. And if you can control your time, that's a good thing. And like most entrepreneurs figure out, you're usually busier than you ever were, but you're happy about it, you know?
Yeah, I love that. Great point. Time is freedom. And that's ultimately what we're all trying to look for. Freedom of decision, freedom
Indeed.
to spend the time with the people we want, the things we want to do. And ultimately that's what sometimes being an entrepreneur can do, but not at first. That
Yeah.
if anything, your freedom gets taken and thrown out the door. You're focused on just trying to get this thing off the ground and doing anything possible to make that happen. So
That's
love
true.
that. We talked about the importance of employment branding and particularly how it's important for candidates to get a realistic job preview when going through the interview process, something I believe very deeply in myself. Why do you think it's important for the trailer to match the movie, which was the acronym or the analogy you used when we talked?
Yeah, I talk a lot about this in a keynote that I do called On a Dime, how to change your culture really quickly. And the whole premise of this is that every organization has a trailer, whether or not they know it. And that trailer is just simply a story that's written by other people and told when you're not in the room, right? And so the two mistakes that companies make are either they're completely oblivious to their trailer. They don't know that it's out there. They don't know what people are saying about them, or they purposely say the wrong one. And when you have that disconnect, people find out about it pretty quick. You got to realize, like, people join your company for a reason more than money. They're coming there for a specific thing. And if they get there on day one and it's different, they're going to leave. I mean, it's the same thing. Like, you go see a movie, right? And you go to see an action-packed space adventure, and you're all psyched about doing that. If you sit down with your popcorn and you're ready, and they give you, I don't know, a romantic tragedy in German song, you're probably going to walk out, right? You know, walk out of the theater, be a little bit annoyed.
Sure.
Well, happens with companies all the time. And so, that realistic preview of what the organization is important first, and then the job preview of what it is. Both have to match really well. And if they don't, you have to do some really concrete actions to fix them or change your story, right?
We're going to come back to it because I want to dive into more what tactics you use to make sure that people have that realistic job preview in the interview process. But let's go here first. We live in a world where creating an employee-focused culture and one of security and belonging is more prioritized than it's ever been, which is a great thing in a lot of ways. But this also can sometimes be at the cost of a performance-based culture. And this is something that I've personally dealt with in my own company and seen in many other companies. You mentioned that feedback is very important here. What do you mean by that? Can you explain?
Yeah, so there's two things. I mean, even before feedback, I mean, there's this thing going on in companies where people are trying to decouple the performance feedback and the reviews that people get and the ratings that they get. And I think this is a complete break with reality. I think the only thing they're decoupling is that break with reality, because every time you get a comp change, whether it's a merit or a bonus, you're getting a review. I mean, if you and I are doing the same job and you get a 6% increase and I get a 2% increase, I got a rating, whether or not they gave it to me, right? And you might actually be mad at them because you were expecting a 7. But, you know, that whole part is important. But I think, you know, when it comes to feedback, it's critical for people to have this. And, you know, it's funny, I did an article on LinkedIn a while ago, how to coach in 60 seconds. And I'm a big boxing fan, right? And I look at the whole thing through the eyes of a boxing trainer. The good ones will give the best feedback possible in only 60 seconds. And they do it by giving you four specific things, right, that they do. You know, they'll talk about, think about somebody going into a round. You just fought for a round, you come back to the corner, and your trainer looks at you. They have to give you very specific praise, right? The things that you're doing well, they have to emphasize that very quickly. I mean, you know, if I ask Tiger Woods, how do you play golf? He's going to say, hit the ball. Well, that doesn't help, right? He doesn't know. If you're in the midst of a project and you're working really hard, you may not recognize all the things you're doing well. So I've got to tell you, hey, that jab you're throwing, keep doing it and actually throw a feint so you can do two of them. Fantastic, right? Then I have to tell you what you're doing wrong. And I think that's where people don't want to do that anymore. You have to tell people, hey, you're tired now. You're dropping your left hand. As you're dropping your left hand, the guy's coming with a hook and hitting you in the face. You probably don't want to do that. Let's stop those. That just took 30 seconds, 45 seconds. Go back out, try it again. That's kind of where you want. And that's all managers have to do, right? And if you do those two things, you're in great shape. But then you got to take it further, because as a leader, you know, you have to be a caretaker for people, right? You have to recognize where you might be involved in a project and you're becoming overwhelmed. Well, there may be a time where I have to throw in the towel for you. I have to bring you back and, you know, let's think about this and how we can fix it. And all the while I'm doing all this, I got to make sure that my feedback is for you and only you. Because even though I got, again, 5 project managers working for me, you're different. You might be a super senior going for the world champion, and another guy's right out of, you know, the school, and this is his first fight. So all of that is important for feedback. And that only takes a minute, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's a book I read a while ago. It's one of my favorites. It's called The Talent Code by Daniel Coyle. And they talk a lot about intentional practice, but mm-hmm. also real-time coaching. So the best way for you to develop a skill and learn quickly is to have that real-time kind of feedback and coaching. And so, you know, if you've ever played basketball and you go out, you're just shooting a bunch of lollygagging shots and you're not getting any better, right? That's not actually improving any skill. If you're very intentional about the rhythm of what you're doing and notice your elbow and arm and you try to get your form right and you do that 100 times, you're going to get better and progress. Similarly, if you have a coach there giving you real-time feedback and then you can go immediately apply it and see what works and what doesn't, data has shown that that's the way that you best learn, the best way you can implement it and get better. It's when you get that immediate feedback and then you can go apply it right away. That's when you're really going to start to see dramatic progress and growth.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. Problem. Yeah, I mean, it's funny that they talk about that. When we're kids, they tell us that practice makes perfect. That's wrong, right? I mean, it's deliberate practice. What you just said, deliberate practice is what gets you, because you can practice the same thing over and over again and you're practicing the wrong thing. You're just reinforcing doing it bad. So
a waste of time. It's not even worth being out there. It's de minimis to what you're trying to do, right?
Yeah. So if you have a good coach in your corner, they can help you. Hey, don't do that. You know, slow down, do this, do that. Okay, great. Now I can go round two in life. I can go practice it and try it again, you know? So that's a big thing, I think, with feedback, is you have to be able to do it well. But then, you know, just as important is after the fight, you've got to get a rating. You know, you'll the judges will give you a scorecard, right? You'll know what it is. And you can look in the mirror and see your face and all the things that you have in life. And that'll know it. But it's helpful. If you ignore that, you're at a loss. You got to guess. Don't make people guess. You know, tell them how they did.
I love that. I love that analogy. We also talked about giving candidates feedback and why they don't get the job. And that's one of the things that, you know, throughout my career, the compliment I got the most, especially when I was executive recruiting, was I would give people feedback with hard stop. Like I would force customers to say, well, what happened? Like, you didn't like the color of their tie. You didn't like this answer. They didn't give enough detail. I need feedback. And I would go back and I would give that. I'm not one to run away from a tough conversation or conflict or anything like that. I was happy to say, hey, here's the feedback on why you didn't get the job, right? And they wouldn't always agree with it. And sometimes they might be a little emotional in the moment to hear it. But my God, almost every single person would reach out to me after the fact and say, thank you for telling me that. Thank you for making me better. Because like you just said a minute ago, like if you can't see like the welts on your face and whether your boxing approach is working or not, then you're going to keep doing the wrong thing. And so I think it's really, really important. I'm so glad you say that. Why do you think it's important? And then I'm just interested, like, was there a moment in your career where this came up for you?
Yeah, I mean, I am such an advocate of doing this because, again, it only takes 5 minutes and you can truly change somebody's life and the trajectory of their career, what they're doing. And it happened to me. I mean, you know, it's funny. Early in my career, I got an interview for a senior OD job. And about 3 minutes into this interview, both of us knew I wasn't qualified. Like it was just way above. I don't know how I got into this thing, instead of like stopping the interview and, you know, just saving his day, giving himself back some time, he gave me this tremendous gift. He told me the truth. He said, look, you have a lot of things going for you. You've done X, Y, and Z. And I was transitioning from sales at the time, so I had a good background. And he said, that's probably what got you in the door. But what I need for this job is X, Y, and Z, and you just don't have it. And then he went on to kind of detail a little bit of that. But the gift that he gave me was a roadmap. So over the next couple of years, I went out and chased those things. And then I was a funny thing happened. You know, this is back in the days where you circle and want ads in the newspaper. Well, I found one and it looked familiar. And I went through the process and got an interview. And sure enough, it was the very same company, the very same job, and the very same guy. He had been posted, right? He was a little promoted on, but he took the interview because he saw the name, he recognized the name. And we had a conversation again. And he said, you know, you don't have everything. You still don't have everything. But you showed that you could learn, you can listen, and you can go get stuff. And he gave me the job. And it totally changed my path because had I not had that first conversation, I would have spent the next how many years guessing at what was important. And instead, this guy just did it, right? And so I try to pay that back all the time because what happens? You go for an interview and, you know, I mean, even before that, you go to apply and there's 2 hours, there's 100 jobs, 100 candidates, 1,000 candidates, and you get lucky enough to get an interview. And then afterwards, you get the old, we've elected to move on with other candidates. That's insulting. That's terrible, right? HR has to be able to do better because if you think about it, the person just invested an hour with you. They got nervous. They prepared. They took off work. They did all these things. And you're going to ghost them or give them a cliche? Come on, man. We can do better. So I think it's just super important, man.
I totally agree with you. And I think you're spot on with that. I love it. Preaching the gospel, preaching the choir. I got to ask you. You've said, yeah, if you're a true boxing purist, this is going to make you roll your eyes. But, you know, I have a curious aside here. What's going to happen in this Jake Paul Mike Tyson fight? Any thoughts?
These are terrible things. So I don't even like to see a Manny Pacquiao fight. I think, you know, that is one of the sports where you can get really hurt. I mean, he's one of the greatest heavyweights of all time. But, you know, time catches up with everybody. And the last thing you want to see is somebody, even if it's an exhibition, to get hit with a punch that kind of knocks your lights out and, you know, reverse. So that it's really tough. Have you ever been in a ring, ever put on pads, ever done anything like that? You get hit, it hurts. And I'm not a big fan of it. I wish they wouldn't. I know it's money. Everyone wants to make the money. I think they have enough already.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what, and you probably grew up in a similar time as me. Boxing was a very revered sport. There's always been issues with it. But like, I just remember like heavyweight fights, playing Mike Tyson's Punch Out as a kid, like looking forward to these big fights where just like they were an event where, you know, very few people could see them on pay-per-view or whatever it may be. And now it's just become so much of the sideshow. But I'll be honest, I'm not probably going to watch this, But I'm very interested in what happens because I don't know what I think, because Paul has proven to be a little bit of a better boxer than I think anybody would have given him credit for. Now, granted, he's, you know, been beating up on a bunch of tomato cans and ex-athletes and stuff like that, but seems like he's like really taking it seriously and knows how to box. And then you got the greatest fighter of my lifetime, right? But he's the hill. He's way over the hill. I hope Mike's not listening. How old is he?
He's pushing 60. I think.
Yeah. So what's going to happen here? Is it the guy who's been there, done that, who still looks like a pit bull? Or is it the guy who's been much, much 30 years younger than him? I don't know. I really don't know what to think.
You can look really good in a clip for 30 seconds. Fighting for 3-minute rounds or 10-minute, 3-minute, that's exhausting.
So you're not picking Tyson is what I'm getting.
No, I'm hoping they change it. But I think something will happen. It'll be more of an exhibition, I hope, because I don't want to see this guy get hurt.
I don't either, man. I don't like, and that's the thing. Like, I find it to be, you know, I get the, like you said, they get the money. How far be it for me to kind of stop anybody from making bread?
I have to tell you, the one thing, a little offside, but on the HR side of things, I mean, Jake Paul has done a good thing on pay for all fighters, right? I mean, here's a guy who comes in, a former YouTuber, nobody was really hot on him, but what he has done, you see with Amanda Serrano and some of these other people getting people paid, and you know, especially the female athletes, because female boxing is now launched. It's amazing. I have a daughter, so I'm all about, hey, you can do whatever you want. And, you know, we're knocking.
That's amazing. I never looked at it that way. And I love how you tied back in the HR compensation justification. This is amazing. Jack, did you know this is going to turn into a boxing podcast?
No.
I didn't either. It's not in my top five sports, but I know enough to be dangerous. So,
there you go.
Wow. We'll be looking forward to seeing what maybe we won't be. We'll see. Let's talk about hiring. Okay, let's get back in the ring here.
All right.
I want to know from you, Tim, you've done a lot of hiring throughout your career. You've led organizations. Do you have a core hiring philosophy that you adhere to?
Just to be of service. When I think about being of service, I want to make the best possible hire for the organization and bring that person in. I don't care about anything else but skill set. And then for the individual, I want to be of service by having them leave with a positive feeling, even if they don't get the job. So they should leave it for something, you know, and having a good feeling on both sides. And that, if you do that well, kind of everything else falls into place. You don't have to worry about a lot of the white noise.
I love that mentality. Are you usually looking for people who are of service too, who share that same mentality?
Yeah. Yeah. You want people who are going to contribute, be humble, you know, work hard, all of the things they taught you in kindergarten, you still want that today, you know?
I love that. Do you have a question that you might ask to kind of identify if that's something of their nature, or do you maybe have a favorite question in general you like to ask in interviews?
Yeah, we kind of talked about it. I mean, I love to ask, what's your X factor? And they, you know, if they give me the, what do you mean? I say, well, okay, you know, we're going for a position, whatever it is. It's a finance job. It's an HR job. There's going to be dozens of other candidates coming in for this role. What do you have that's unique and special? And I give them time to think about it, because I want to bring the thing that they have that's unique. So if I get 10 finance guys for a role, and one of them says, you know, I love presenting data and having discussions and talking about the insights from that. And I read, okay, well, you're a finance guy that loves to get on stage and talk about presentation. You know, okay, unique thing. You're an HR person who's also a social media. Okay, you just now given me the leather bucket seats on the car. And I want to pull that from people to see if it fits.
What we like to do here on this show, we like to ask the questions right back to our guests. So what's your X factor, Tim?
I like to connect the dots for folks. I like to make the connections with what folks think they're saying out there versus what they really are. So we talked a lot about that boxing. I like to be the trainer. I like to see the unseen pointed out and then have people become better because of it.
Love that. I would say my X factor is the combination of authentically curious with growth mindset. So I constantly want to get better and iterate and improve, be better day after day. But I also have this genuine curiosity about people, things, what's going on around me that I want to learn about so I can apply it and try to get better on a day in and day out basis. And I think whatever role you bring me in, then that combination of those two things can be super powerful.
That's cool.
Appreciate that. I didn't know you were going to ask that, but I always like to answer the questions because I like to put myself in the interview seat. Let's go back. You gave me an amazing interview story. Do you have another one, or is that, did we get the cream of the crop there? Do you have a memorable interview if I asked you?
Oh, so something that I'm interviewing.
Yeah, either you were interviewing somebody or you were interviewing. Now, you did tell me the one a minute ago, so I'll allow you to punt on this one. But is there another like great interview that you can remember or
You
one
know,
that's
it's so many. I mean, I think I'm like you that you're always surprised by what people are bringing to the table. And I think that X factor thing, you know, you learn just so many things. Somebody comes in for a job as a finance, situation. You find out that they're a pilot, and they say, okay, well, how is that important? And one person was telling me a story about how he was just started his flight training, and when you do that, you run on virtual flight. You're not using instruments. And he says, you really got to watch the weather, and your instructor will do that because if you go into cloud, you're totally lost. And I said, okay, well, how do you train for that? And he says, well, you have to, they put you in something called unusual attitudes and unusual altitudes, it is. And he says, they make you wear a helmet like Star Wars. You can't see anything except your instruments. And then the instructor will move the plane around. And so he'll move it around, and the instructor might have it where it's going down to the left, and your whole body is go thinks that the plane is going up and to the right. And you have to ignore your body, he said, and focus on your instruments. And if you don't do that, you'll die because you'll move the plane in the wrong way and crash. And so I said, well, that's interesting. And I'm like, well, how does that apply to what you do? And he goes, I watch the scorecards. And I was blown away because here's somebody who goes, there's all noise, all anecdotal evidence, all kinds of things that come at you, and I focus on the instruments. And I was like, dude, that's awesome.
of that. That's incredible. I think here's what's crazy. And this is why I get like, this is why I say the resume is the 10% of the story. The job description is 10% of the story. The story is the story, right? How you got to where you're at. And so for somebody to think that getting your pilot's license is in no way relevant to whatever job you're pursuing is crazy to me, right? You had to take the, you know, there's a lot of testing and things that you've got to do to be able to do that. So you're showing some level of commitment. And resilience there. There's all different types of things that happen in a plane that you have to be ready for, whether it be dealing with white noise like you're talking about, or pressure and dealing with that, or multiple different things coming at you. These are all things that can apply to many, many jobs. And so I would hate for somebody not to have that on their resume, or for me to have hired somebody and learned that's a big part of who they are and their identity, and that have not come up in the interview. Because I think that's in so many ways applicable. And to your point, I love the finance analogy too, right? Like if you have somebody that's kind of falling into a typical archetype and you're evaluating them against other people, but this one steps out of that and does XYZ and really enjoys that and passionate, well, that X factor is what really takes that person to the next level and potentially makes them a great hire, which is the name of the game.
I think it's really important, and you know, for everybody, but even especially younger folks as they come in, because they may be thinking, well, I don't have a strong background yet, I don't have a good, strong career. Think about all the things that you've done, the projects you've done in school, the volunteer work that you've done, all the things that are there, that are transferable skills that you can really take advantage of. So it's important.
Yeah, and that's the advice I'd give to somebody that doesn't have a very robust resume but is interviewing. It's like, how can you take the experiences you've had at school and extracurriculars and athletics, working at the bar or the restaurant you worked at? How can you apply that? Because if you can draw that line there for somebody, then you can really get jobs that you're really not qualified for, right? If you can do that effectively. What we talked a little bit about creating that realistic job preview. What do you do in the interview scenario that you try to give people an understanding of what they're walking into, what it's like to work for you? Can't be all puppy dogs and lollipops, of course. So how are you kind of conveying some of the tougher parts to them?
Yeah, it's funny. So I guess it starts with the job descriptions. I think that they sometimes are fundamentally useless. They give you a laundry list of things, and then they say everything else as required, right? What I like to do with job descriptions is actually break down subject areas. So instead of giving you an endless list of things, here are the four buckets that of activity, general activity that you're going to be doing. And then even go so far as to put percentages of how important they are. Because what I think about that job description becomes how you're going to get rated. And what are your goals going to look like? What is your performance review going to look like? And if I can give candidates a view of what that picture is, then they know, hey, I don't have everything, but maybe that, I don't know, think about sales administration. I don't know, it's the sales administration, but I'm great with the sales funnel, and I'm great with negotiation, and we're good. Okay, well, the one that you were worried about was worth 10% of everything. That's not that important, right? So I can help people weed themselves in and out. And then when we get in the discussion, we can make it more robust because it's there. So I think part of it is putting it in paper. And then the second thing is answering the questions on the interview and saying, here's what it is, man. Here's what was going to be most important. One of the best, I think one of the best questions you could ask as a candidate is, how can I make your life easier? Right? Imagine talking to, getting interviewed by your peer, getting interviewed by your manager, and you asking them, hey, how can I make your life easier? The questions or the answers that you get can be so revealing because you may have a peer who says, I just can't stand doing X, Y, or Z. And you might say, I'm great at that. This is the natural collaboration that we've just discovered. I'm your guy. Right? So you gotta think about that.
I love it. I'm writing that down. We got to use that one. That's a good one. What about when you invariably we miss, right? Tim, no matter how good we are at this. So I'm just interested, when you miss on somebody, is there like a theme you can look back on that I wish I would have done this differently, or I missed this, or I moved too fast, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes when I miss, I think the trend early in my career was when you didn't trust your gut. So I'm big on data. I'm big on, making sure you get the proof points in the interviews and the stories. But when something seems off, and I think I've discovered what that is, at least for me, it's the balance between we and I language when people are talking. And it seems kind of a novice mistake now, but earlier it was when people said, I did this, I did this, I made this goal. And it really should have been the we. You know, we did that, we did this, we shepherded this project across. And people are sometimes afraid to say that. And actually, that's a really powerful thing, because if you tell somebody, I was involved in a large project implementation and we were able to do X, Y, and Z. Fantastic. My next question is, what was your part in that? And then you could break it down. But people are sometimes scared to do that. What I discovered is when I let that go and I assume that they've done all this, and then they come in and they can't punch that weight, and boy, we're in trouble. And that's on me.
That's really good feedback. I mean, I think that there's something to, you know, there's lots of different things that I see that we miss on, right? Unclear expectation, ambiguity on what you'd be walking into. Sometimes you want to fill a role so quickly, or you've just been taking the legwork yourself. So you just start rationalizing things. And a lot of times, like, gut is really and one of the things that we're trying to build with our software is codifying your gut. Because really what your gut is, it's experience and intuition, right? That is maybe not like clearly explaining to you why you feel the way you do, but it's very clearly saying, I feel this way. And so listening to that gut a lot of times is very important. It's also can be something of a self-fulfilling prophecy though, too. If you had a bad gut feeling, but you're like, all right, I'll sign off on it. Are you giving that person every opportunity to kind of move beyond that and be open-minded? Now, there's a bunch of different factors here, but just, I guess the point is that hiring is not linear. And so when you go through this process, we're all victims of our own biases, conscious and unconscious. I'm with you. I think that every time that I've kind of felt a way that I couldn't articulate it properly, and we brought that person on board, it hasn't worked out. And it was because only later, after I've started to see where they're strong and where they're not, I can verbalize, that was missing. So just not being able to verbalize it, sometimes it's something, a step to take a deeper look and rethink things and really reflect, because there's something in your experience or intuition that's calling that out for you.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it goes back to what we talked about earlier. I mean, it's everything is art and science. I mean, you can get all the science right, and then there's this little thing in the back of your mind is like, okay, you got to pause and take a closer look. So that makes perfect sense.
I love it. I was going to make a comment about, you know, I actually don't think that, you know, I think it's funny is that people have been trying to automate recruitment for the longest time. And I just think it's such folly, because the human experience and aspect of it, I think, is so key. There are administrative components. There are ways that AI can help. I'm deeply obsessed with those things and want to make them better. But I don't see this getting replaced anytime soon. You know, automating a car getting from A to B, totally get it. Automating a printing press or a manufacturing press, totally get it. A complex and nuanced thing that takes both art and science, there are certainly ways technology can empower, but not replace, in my opinion, not yet. We'll see how things, you know, evolve over into the future. I'm interested, though, is there an HR technology that you love, or have you seen anything in the talent space that's really kind of lit you on fire?
No, I think it's gotten overwhelmed. I mean, I try to keep up with all the new, and you know, AI is kind of the big thing that's there. I think there's a level of automation, but it's really more of the blocking and tackling of that. I think you're spot on when you think about especially in the interactions and connections. So yeah, AI can help you with your employee relations and get data quicker and make analysis, but I think there's a beauty between the data and the insight that really only people can do. Maybe someday in the future, yeah, but it still requires that art.
Is somebody who's building technology in this space, it's funny because I think about social media, right? And the promise of social media in the early 2000s was it's going to bring us together, right? It's going to make people that are like across the globe feel closer. But in a lot of ways, it's really isolated us even more and made us less human interactive, right? And I don't want that to happen in this space. I think that there's certain things that technology should be empowering the human touch, the human capability, right? And that to me, interviewing is one of them. I believe that you're going to work for somebody at the end of the day, and knowing that person, building a rapport with that person, learning what makes them tick, really only happens in this type of situation. Now, again, there can be technology that can empower and enable, you know, insights or administrative components that you don't want to do or you don't have to do, right? But gosh, like for me, it'd be like, you know, can you imagine doing this interview with AI? I mean, no thanks, right? Like you're not building a real rapport. You're not really like. It's different. And so there's certain things that technology should be empowering the human condition instead of disempowering.
Yeah, and that probably in the recruiting space is even harder because when you think about recruiters, they have such the job of doing that double sale. It's harder than any other role because you're talking to the person who's hiring and making sure that they understand their needs, and then this candidate, and both have to be sold exactly right to make the connection. Good luck, right? And I'm actually concerned that we use it too much, and then you filter people out, and then you don't make those. I guess what I say sometimes is you can't schedule serendipity. Sometimes you have to just let it happen and let it organically generate, and there's no bot for that.
And what I really blame this on to a degree is if I look at a lot of, you know, the agencies out there or even some of the internal TA people, they treat it like a commoditized transaction at the end of this idea of hiring, right? This let's get the resumes in, let's review them, let's get them through this process. And one of the things I'm loving about our conversation is you have so much more empathy and depth to you that you actually have intentionality around giving candidates feedback that help make them better. But so many hiring managers, it's like, boom, interview, 30 minutes of questions, move out, move in, right? And because recruiters in a lot of ways have treated it as a very commoditized thing, people have thought, well, we got to automate this. We got to just like, you know, it's just eradicate it and get technology. That's not how it should be. There should be, it's so complex. It's so nuanced, in my opinion, to do it well. It's one of those great things where everybody thinks they're amazing at hiring. And then if you actually go and look at the data, it's actually quite ineffective in a lot of ways. And so we've got to figure out this perfect blend of how you marry science, because there is some level of analytics and data that should come into this to help us make better decisions. But also, like I said, making sure that we keep the nature of the human involved and treat this like a service, serendipity. I love that.
Yeah, it is funny. People, when they say that they're great at hiring, great at talent, I say, well, how many people are lined up to work for you? If that was true, then the business would own time to fill. And you'd have this certain level of managerial gravity where, and we all know it, somebody has a role that opens and you go, oh no, not him again. Because it's going to be a pain to get somebody to work for him. And then other people, when they have a role open, you're like, that's no big deal. It'll be filled tomorrow because they've got a pipeline of folks who are dying to get that job just to learn from that person. And that circles back to what we talked about with brand. If you have that great brand.
Yeah, said another way, also, like, let's say you have a team of like 10 people. How many of those 10 would you absolutely rehire again and want to work? Like, I think most people are not going to say 10 out of 10. And that's
Yeah.
because, listen, it's just like sports. Like, let's go through the draft history of every professional sports team. You can't go 2 years without there being somebody that didn't work out, a bust, or somebody that never meet their potential. It's because this is hard. We got to
Yeah.
understand that. We got to accept that. We've got to be able to also try to force it and get better at it. Because you know what's not working is coming in and just shooting guns and be guns ablazing about questions. And here's what I like to ask. And you know, there's just not enough certainty in this space. That is something that I am obsessed and passionate about trying to solve. I certainly know myself firsthand. I haven't made every great hire in the world. I don't know that everybody would be lining up to work for me. I'd like to think that that's the case, but you don't know that. And that's why it's something that I continue to want to get better at myself, but also create technology and services that empower others to be great at it. Tim, I want to ask you, is there anything you're working on right now you're super excited about?
So actually working on a new keynote, start in the early stages, because I want to do a little bit more about giving back. And most of the stuff that I talk about is performance and talent and all of that. But I'm actually working on something now around overcoming adversity. And I want to speak to the younger folks, college and high schools, and get them rallied around kind of the what's coming up. Because you know what? We always say that back in my day, well, back in my day wasn't hard. Every day's hard, right? So I want to make sure that folks are prepared. And so that's just a nice side. I got a side hustle to a side hustle that I want to get really excited about.
I love that. Did you see the NVIDIA CEO had a quote last week around suffering? He's like, I wish suffering upon you. He was talking to Stanford grads. Did you see it?
No, I haven't seen it.
You got to Google it afterwards. I bet you throw it into your keynote, because it was just amazing, because he just talks about how, you know, many of you are in Stanford and you've lived this world of like, you had a goal and you got it, and you got a goal and you hit it. And you're like, it was just kind of like these things, just that's how the world works. And ultimately, especially being an entrepreneur, that is not how it works. Like, you have to go through many failures and much suffering to get it. And he's like, and that's what builds character, right? It's not intelligence that leads to greatness. It's character that leads to greatness. And you can't have great character without going through adversity and suffering. So he goes, so I wish suffering on all of you, at least at some level. You should watch that quote. You should watch that. You'll really like that. Are you reading, is anything you've read recently that you want to recommend, or any content you've seen that you want to put out there?
So, I think just more of a concept. I think that the helpful for folks in doing some thinking and writing around this is the idea of the imposter syndrome, right? There's been so much buzz around this. And I think it's really important for folks to understand that there's this marked difference between having imposter syndrome and being an imposter. So many of us are told to fake it till we make it and act as if. And again, this is going back to what's on my mind now with the younger folks. And I think we're missing a trick on that, because somewhere we've convinced ourselves that we've got to operate as if we've already done everything, even though we haven't even been in the ring yet. And I think that we're missing the value of newness. There's such an amazing opportunity that you have when you step into a new job, when you step into a new career, or just even a new day, that you can approach things in a way that's different than everybody else around you. And that is incredibly valuable. So don't try to fake it into thinking that you're the world champion. Again, go back to our boxing analogy. If this is the first time you put on gloves, you're going to get knocked to the canvas. Instead, kind of think about all the things that you could bring to the table by having a different perspective. And that's what's been on my mind a lot lately.
Thank you. Imposter syndrome is such a bullshit concept, in my opinion. Like, everybody who is progressing in any type of way is doing something new that they've never done before. Every first-time parent has imposter syndrome. Every time you step into a new job or a new company, you have imposter syndrome. Every time you meet a new group of friends, there's some level of imposter syndrome. Sometimes it'll work out. Sometimes it won't, right? But we all go through things that we're not 100% sure are going to go the way we want them to, or that we're capable of just yet. But the reality of the situation is just to lean into that newness, lean into that learning, give yourself some grace, give yourself an opportunity to kind of fill in those holes over time. Because everybody's dealing with that in tons of scenarios, many times, multiple times in a year. So like, I don't know, like confidence is important. Confidence game is great. But like, to your point, you don't have to fake it till you make it. There is something to be said about, I'm new at this. I'm going on the listening tour. I'm taking in everything. I'm going to make my own assessment. I'm going to start to apply this stuff that I think actually gives you a lot of value long-term in any new role and any new function, whatever.
Yeah, you learn on the job. You know, you do that and people respect it. And then if you do it, they're more apt to listen to you. And that's sometimes where you make the greatest contribution, because you just have a different insight or a different opinion or a different view just from your sake of being brand new to the whatever it is.
Cool. There's power in that. Tim, last question for me. What's a bit of advice that maybe you would have given yourself early in your career, maybe somebody early in their career listening to this, that you didn't know then, but you know now?
I mean, part of it is just exactly that. I mean, I think is when you step into something new, listen. learn, right? You don't want to stop learning because you've quote unquote made it, because you're going to go and make it a bunch of other times, right? So when you walk into a new job, a new role, take your time to be a student. And if you think you got there, then you want to do two things. You want to go get a mentor and you want to be a mentor. And I call it, stand in the middle, because then you learn from both directions and it's great. And if you can do that your whole career, boy, you're in good shape. But that's something when you're younger, you think about getting a mentor, you don't think about teaching. And everybody has something to give and something to learn. And if you can do that consistently throughout your career, boy, you're going to be in good shape.
In the middle. I really like that. All right, Tim, you do a lot of speaking engagements. So if people want to follow up more and learn more about you, like where would they go? Where can they find some of these? I see you are on a TED Talk. I see that it sounds like you got a keynote coming up. Where can they find this stuff?
Yeah, you can go to timtotaride.com. It's pretty easy. Just well, the last name isn't. I apologize for that. Timtotaride.com, or just connect with me on LinkedIn. And that's probably the easiest way.
Love it. We'll have it in the show notes. They'll see it on the byline of the upcoming podcast. I really appreciate you coming on, Tim. It was a great conversation. Thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure.
All right, brother. I appreciate it.